아마 생각이 제가
that ketchup will be necessary when we are done. We are late already. We are behind time because to accommodate people who got lost. Parliament is very big. People, they got lost. They get lost. Speaking of truth to power is revolutionary. So, the purpose of the meeting today, honorable members, you are clear with it. We're going to receive a presentation or analysis from Dr. Mthembu on risks to South African foreign policy, hoping that it will empower us as members of the portfolio and enable us to be able to craft our own strategies and plans as a portfolio committee moving forward. I saw the advocate, welcome advocate, the chief state law advisor, is invited by us during our orientation. We are happy that you honor that invitation because foreign service bill is on top of our priorities as a portfolio. We want the bill to be back on our tables and table it to Parliament. And your presentation will assist us as a committee to take a decision to say we are reviving the bill as soon as possible so that we are able to move swiftly. And we know that it will also enable DERCO to do some of the things without hindrance. So I welcome all of you to this important session of our portfolio committee meeting. Without wasting time, we're hoping to be out of here by 1 o'clock. We are not a committee of boardroom. We want things to be done. We are a committee of action. So boardrooms for us are just a delaying tactic. Some of the things which are very important. So I'm going to allow Dr. Mthembu to brief us on the risks to SA foreign policy. I'm told that he has no presentation.
I've actually taken it from my laptop.
Would be very nice.
But I will be sending a copy.
It would have been nicer if you got that presentation a day before you come here. You know, we are a bunch of readers in this committee. We like reading, so please, we are not lazy readers. We like reading. Even if you send us as many documents as possible, I promise you, we will read and we will empower ourselves with those documents. So, without wasting time, we are going to allow the Secretary of the Committee to present apologies, and then after apologies, Dr. Mtembu will shoot to the presentation. Thank you. I'm thinking the same way, that there's people who are trying to run me amok here in my meeting. They are taking over the children of the meeting. They want to create anarchy. Yeah. We don't want anarchy in this portfolio. Are you ready, Dr. Mtem? Okay. Over to you. What is that? Is it a point of before exigency? Okay.
The meeting overruns myself and Member Muyala. We have to be in another meeting at exactly 1 o'clock.
Are you a spokesperson of Muyala, Honorable Muyala, or some kind of George Bezos of his? He can't speak for himself. No. What time is that?
Because the meeting is around,
we
can leave at
5 to 1. By that time, we'll be done. You don't need to submit an apology. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. It's a bit, I apologies for turning my back to you, but I think if the audio is fine, I think everyone can hear me, and parts of the points that I'll be raising are on the screen. Just a bit of background, that what we do is annually as an institute, as a foreign policy institute, is that at the beginning of the year, we try to...
Botella,
yes.
You must just introduce yourself. We don't know you. Now, you are talking about institutes, and we are looking at each other like that. We are like, what is that now? So, please introduce yourself for the benefit of the portfolio committee and everyone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Apologies. My assumption was obviously wrong. I think... Firstly, my name is Philani Mtembu. I'm joined by Ms. Sanusha Naidu on my right. She is a senior research fellow at the Institute for Global Dialogue. Let's see. Hello? Is that better? Okay. So, Philani Mtembu, I'm heading the Institute for Global Dialogue. It's a foreign policy think tank founded in 1995. And we do a lot of work on South African foreign policy. We do work on international diplomacy. We do work on geopolitical dynamics. And we also have a center for Latin America and the Caribbean. We do also a lot of work, not only at involving track one diplomacy, but we focus also on track two and track three diplomacy, which also revolves around the work on think tanks in the international relations space, but also around civil society in the international relations space. So as we see international relations evolving, we see that there's increasingly more actors, not only at a sub-state level, but also at a non-state level. And that brings about important challenges when it comes to actually coordinating all of these different actors within the field of international relations. So this presentation stems really from our work on South Africa in the world. We'll make sure we do send some of those copies, but every 2 or 3 years we publish what is called South African Foreign Policy Review, which looks at all the various aspects of South African foreign policy. The third volume has just been published with the Human Sciences Research Council, and that goes into a whole range of areas from parliamentary diplomacy to economic diplomacy to the role of special advisors, and it really touches on a whole range, and that we do every 2 to 3 years. So what this is today is just really going to be an overview. I'll try to make sure that we don't spend too much time presenting. You know, I think at most even not more than 30 minutes just on presenting just some of the key highlights pertaining to South Africa in the world and some of the risks and opportunities. The first point, and my colleague will come in from time to time also to emphasize particular areas. The first point is just to take note of is the fact that we have about 126 diplomatic missions abroad and over 160 foreign representatives in South Africa. And with that, the country is arguably host to one of the largest diplomatic community in the world. I mean, literally outside of Washington, a country of South Africa's size, it really has a large diplomatic presence, not only in terms of our footprint in the world, but also in terms of the world's footprint in South Africa. And I think that makes the work of not just the committee, but also of scholars working on international relations. It works that makes their job that much more important, because it cannot be right that it's outside of Washington that the whole world is here, and yet that the majority of our population are largely internally focused. So it's absolutely important that the work of international relations, that it also goes out beyond the nation state and beyond state actors, and that we bring people along and actually conscientize people about the importance of international relations and of South Africa's particular role within the world. And I think that relates very well with also some of the recent developments in South Africa. I know a full assessment is still yet, you know, is still going to be, you know, made in terms of what sparked, you know, recent activities in the country. But it's absolutely important that we take note that there's a disproportion in terms of South Africa's real role on the continent with how much our citizens actually know about the continent and actually know about South Africa's engagement on the continent and the importance of that. And it relates with the earlier point that if we don't make it a point of ensuring that the rest of society understands the importance of South Africa's engagement in Africa, that it's the citizens themselves that will be eventually asking questions of why we are even engaged in international relations and why we don't divert resources, for instance, internally instead of growing our footprint in the world. So that's a quite an important point. It's also important because it comes at a time when South Africa is sitting for the third time in as a non-permanent member in the UN Security Council, and it also prepares to chair the African Union in 2020. One of the key things that are important is the tools of South African foreign policy, and one of the areas that we've done a considerable amount of work on is on the role of development diplomacy. It's clear that on the continent we live in, the linkages between peace and development are quite close. So in as much as the country is involved in post-conflict resolution, but it's also equally important that the country is engaged in the post-conflict situation in terms of how can we assist countries on the continent achieve their own development goals. And one of the more visible vehicles for South Africa has been the African Renaissance Fund. Now, the African Renaissance Fund is important in terms of its visibility and in terms of its standout role for actually bringing about the African agenda and the development agenda within the continent. But it's also important to keep in mind that it is not the sole body responsible for South Africa's international development engagements. In fact, South Africa is quite a decentralized system of international development cooperation in the sense that every department is involved in international cooperation. Defense is involved, science and technology is involved, and in fact they've been involved in a lot of trilateral cooperation. And you know, the graphs there, you can go into them later, but essentially the funds that have been allocated to DIRCO in the over a period from 2003 to around 2015, you can see that it's around 4 billion that was allocated to DIRCO, and in terms of expenditure it was sitting at around 3.2 billion. And the annual reports, go into some of the intricacies, why in certain years there was less spent and why in certain years there was more spent. But what's important and what's clear is that after the global financial crisis from around 2008, there's clearly been a decline in the amount of allocations that have come from the African Renaissance Fund. Now, part of that is partly linked to South Africa's role on the continent, but also part of that it can also be linked, I think, to this impending implementation of the South African Development Partnership Agency. There is an understanding that a lot of the projects will be wrapped down before the SADPA actually comes in. But this is one of the important, I think, areas that the committee will potentially be engaged in, is in terms of really understanding where we are in terms of implementing SADPA. And in terms of the different models out there that are available, we've seen that while South Africa has been grappling with implementing SADPA, other countries in the global south have actually, and in the global north, have been making various changes to their international development cooperation frameworks. So countries like India, for instance, have now got a development partnership agency which coordinates the government's international engagements. You've also got in China a new agency. Brazil has been quite involved for some time in this area and in terms of tracking its annual disbursements. But essentially what's important is that with the sustainable development goals taking us to 2030, countries of the global south, countries like South Africa, are going to play important roles in terms of lessons on development, in terms of assisting other countries in their respective regions to shape their development policies. And that's where something like a South African Development Partnership Agency comes in. And I'll let Ms. Anusha Naidu just step in there just to go into some of the areas that have been engaged in, because the think tanks also continually engage on various fora, whether it's under the BRICS, whether it's under your G20. And one of the areas that remain important is the formation of a South African Development Partnership Agency, while the rest of the world essentially moves ahead in structuring their own institutions.
Thank you very much, Pilani. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. Again, thank you for the opportunity to brief the committee on the work that we do. My name, as Pilani had indicated earlier, is Sanusha Naidu. I'm a Senior Research Associate based with the Institute and working on areas of foreign policy and in particular looking at countries from the emerging South and how they are dealing or putting together or crafting policy in respect of their engagements in the broader context of the global arena. The one thing I have to say is that what we've witnessed with regard to development cooperation is a shift in thinking and narrative, particularly with regard to the countries of the global South, where the value, the effectiveness, and the promotion of South-South cooperation has become a very key aspect of the development cooperation landscape in the last several years. Most importantly, I think what we have to be very aware of is that the traditional donors, particularly, or even the language has changed in recent years, but traditional donors from the developed economies, what we call development assistant countries of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in the West, OECD, they have started to move the narrative towards what I would say is very important, that extends from the Millennium Development Goals, which was the global compact of the MDGs, to Sustainable Goal 17 in terms of how you create cooperation around development initiatives and so forth under the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals. And what has been very fundamental to the shift in the thinking, particularly in policy, has been the area around bringing the Global South in, because they can contribute to both financial and non-financial resources to both the OECD DAC countries in terms of instruments, in terms of financial disbursements, but more importantly, I think, in how countries like China and India want to also become have more traction in the development cooperation agenda, but also to lead that agenda in terms of impact. And I think what we've realized is that one of the aspects of that is called trilateral development cooperation. And trilateral development cooperation is where I think South Africa has played a very significant role in the last several years, particularly under the African Renaissance Fund, but also in terms of helping countries to be able to implement development projects. And let me give you an example, or let me give you a definition of what trilateral development cooperation is. There's different interpretations, but my understanding of it, and I'm sure Pilani would add to this, is you have money coming from country A, but they don't want to get directly involved in the disbursement of the projects and how the project is implemented. They feel that a country from the Global South, like South Africa in the region of SADC, can actually be better placed to help implement the project. So the money goes to a country like Lesotho, and what then happens is that South Africa helps to implement that project because it has capacity and development skills and training to do that. And then, of course, country C, being Lesotho, is the recipient. We have an example of this, and that is, I think it was Irish Aid to Lesotho, which was a potato ash project that they had provided. They were very interesting responses from both the recipient country, the donor country, or the country that was that gave the money, and South Africa's experience, both positive and some challenges to the effectiveness of the project. But this is where we're going to. I don't want to get into too much of detail around this, but one of the challenges that did come up from the country that was the recipient was that there wasn't more transfer of skill from South Africa in terms of capacity building, institutional and structural impact. So I think what's important for us to bear in mind, and I don't want to take up too much time, is to just remember that one of the things that we have to be very, we have to think about is how China, or the BRICS in particular, and this leads into the next point that Palani will speak about, and that is how the development landscape is changing. Part of this development landscape, which I think for South Africa in terms of the institutional architecture that we have to think about in terms of development assistance, is whether we can afford to be giving the money or whether we should be thinking about the role we can play in terms of capacity building and institutional architecture that we can shape. The second point to make here is, given the constraints we have in resources, it will be very important to evaluate when SACPA gets legislated, when you have the African Renaissance Fund being transferred and the International Development Fund comes into place, what would be the mandate of SACPA in going forward? The objectives, the purpose, etc., will remain the same, but I think we'll have to start thinking about how it fits for purpose in a changing global architecture. Just to give you an example, recently China, there was an evaluation of China's development agency, and they also found that their capacity is constrained, that the resources are constrained because of their own internal domestic constraints with regard to money that they may not have. And one of the things that we found in 2015 was the financing for development conference that took place in Addis Ababa made a very important decision that the role of the private sector also needs to be incorporated into the space. So I think with BRICS on the horizon and with where the mandate of BRICS will be going, it's important to see how it's not just investment in terms of direct financial resources, but also investment in capacity building and resource building. And I think this is where countries like Germany and others can and China and India play a critical role. One last point to make about how SACPA can play a role at the domestic level. I think one of the interesting examples I've seen, and we saw this recently in India, was the Forum on International Development Cooperation that the Indians had put forward, where part of the International Development Cooperation is not just about India being a development actor and providing funds to other countries, but also how they reconstitute the domestic landscape in understanding where funds need to go at a sub-national level. And this has been quite a successful innovation on South-South Cooperation. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think just building on that, I mean, it's really just to emphasize that as South Africa grapples with the idea of SATPA, the modalities and so forth, we just need to be cognizant that, you know, the world is, you know, moving full steam ahead in terms of formulating their own roles as development actors. In fact, a last point on this matter is that South Africa was actually one of the first countries amongst the Global South to actually discuss the issue of a development agency in the form of SATPA. So we were actually one of the first movers on this. But because we haven't been able to implement SATPA, other countries have actually overtaken us in that regard and experimented with their own development agencies. I think another important area, which I won't go into detail with because I know it will be discussed later by the committee, is that the Foreign Service Bill is a potential opportunity for the country in terms of actually professionalizing our Foreign Service. And I think there's a lot of opportunities in that. It's the first time that South Africa has actually come up with such an initiative, and it will, I think, if taken to its logical conclusion, assist in beefing up our diplomatic service. And that's important because if we are going to be talking about the importance of economic diplomacy, then it's also important that we have also the requisite skills in all those 126 missions to actually search for those opportunities and link those opportunities with the country. The last issue on this area is the importance not only of track one diplomacy, which is at the government-to-government level, but to also the acknowledgement of Track 2 and Track 3. Track 2 is really where the think tanks and academic institutions are involved. As we speak, next week there's going to be a BRICS academic forum. And this has become a traditional thing that every time before the heads of summit actually meet at the BRICS, you also have meetings of think tanks amongst the BRICS countries who share research on various areas. And within the BRICS, South Africa has been particularly tasked with issues of social justice. So that's an important area, and a lot of our scholars, our South African scholars from different institutes, participate quite actively in these fora. They also participate in fora such as the T20, which is every time preceding the G20 summit, is that there will be a meeting of think tanks also to discuss policy recommendations for the heads of state. So you've also got also obviously the Business 20 meeting, you've got trade unions meeting. So international relations has really involved more actors in recent years. I just put a few graphs, I won't go into them really in detail, but it really just highlights how economic diplomacy, given our domestic challenges when it comes to growth, when it comes to unemployment, how economic diplomacy is going to basically be quite critical for the current and future administrations. Some of the markets that have been pointed out by the Department of Trade and Industry, for instance, you'll see in the tables, are some of these fast-growing economies within the continent, and such as within sub-Saharan Africa, you've got Angola, Cameroon, DRC, Ethiopia, Ghana, Kenya, Mozambique, Nigeria, Senegal. You'll notice with a lot of these countries is that they are countries outside also of the SADC region. Because once you see a lot of the geography of South Africa's trade, while we do speak about a strong South Africa-Africa trade, you notice that at a disaggregated level, a lot of that trade is within the SADC. So if you look at, for instance, our exports into the world, you'll see that our top three export destinations is China, Germany, and the U.S. And then after them, you have Botswana, Namibia, Japan, the UK, India, Belgium, and Mozambique. So out of our top 10, export destinations, three of them are from the SADC region, which really just points to the importance of that region for our trade. In terms of imports also, China, Germany, US, again, are our key sources of imports. And then you've got India, Japan, Saudi Arabia, UK, Nigeria. So it helps to just have a picture of who are some of our key partners when it comes to exports and imports. I think it's important also to put it within the African continent in a sense that when you say South Africa's exports to Africa, you can really see with this table that you're largely talking about Southern Africa. You've got Botswana in the lead, then Namibia, Mozambique, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Swaziland, Lesotho, Democratic Republic of Congo, Angola, and then Kenya. So it's quite important that as the country looks to diversify its export sources, that it looks beyond the SADC region. And opportunities will be created in this regard by the African Continental Free Trade Area. I'll skip some of the other graphs, but essentially it goes into exports to Europe, which shows that it's Germany, UK, and Belgium, which are our top in this regard. And then, of course, in the Americas, you've got the U.S., Brazil, Canada, Argentina, Mexico. Those are our key partners. when it comes to exports and imports from those particular regions. I think an important area to highlight is that what we're seeing on the continent is that economic growth is really showing no signs of slowing down. We know that Africa's demographics will, its population will double by 2050. That presents both risks and opportunities. And when you exclude the large African economies like Angola, Nigeria, and South Africa, which, you know, ironically, as the large economies, they've been the ones who have actually been dragging the continent's growth potential. So it's really, if you exclude those large countries, you see that out of really the fastest growing economies in the world, at least half of them are actually coming from the African continent. And this presents opportunities for South Africa. You'll see also that despite that growth, there are areas we need to look at, such as rising debt levels amongst some of these countries. At least 14 countries on the continent have been highlighted as being at high risk of debt distress, and that is something that we obviously need to monitor over time. In terms of some of their debt sources from Europe and particularly also China. In terms of the African Continental Free Trade Area, I mean, that provides big opportunities for the continent. It provides opportunities in a sense that there's expectations that it will be a game changer, with the potential to raise intra-Africa trade by 25%, so between 50 and 70 billion by 2040. And this is important because one of the key challenges is the low levels of intra-Africa trade. And it continues to be below 20%. And the target is that the African Continental Free Trade Area will assist in actually taking those numbers forward and creating opportunities. But there's also going to be difficult discussions to be had, that as we talk about the free movement of goods and services on the continent, is that increasingly we'll also have to talk about also the free movement of people on the continent. And to what extent are the various sub-regions of the continent ready for that free movement of people? What implications are there for a country like South Africa? What implications are there for smaller countries on the continent? And those are questions that will be opened up by the Continental Free Trade Area. You'll also see just a table there with about 20 elections taking place on the African continent throughout 2019. And of course, elections, as we know, present their own opportunities, but they also present their own risks within the continent. So those are areas that we need to be continually monitoring. I'll let Sanusha come in when it comes to this growing foreign engagement on the continent. I mean, we're seeing this increasing courting of the African continent and these Africa summits where one major power meets with African counterparts to discuss various issues. And I'll just let Sanusha elaborate on that.
Thank you, Pilani. Just before I elaborate on that, I just want to make two points on the African Continental Free Trade Agreement. I think we've seen how many countries have ratified it, which means now that they have a small executive committee in terms of taking the decisions around the ratification process, etc. This happened in July, where about 22 countries have ratified, which then means that the African Free Trade Agreement is now in effect an instrument that is going to have to go forward. The challenge, and I think this is part of where South Africa has to also start thinking about, how do you institutionalize the instruments of the free trade agreement. In particular, two instruments around tariff and non-tariff barriers. Because in part, tariff and non-tariff barriers, the tariff barriers are essentially around your rules of origin of trade. So if we are sitting in South Africa now where our manufacturing sector is facing a serious dearth in terms of it's not moving forward, we're not producing, we're not creating jobs, we are in a situation, in a very sticky situation. It's going to cause a lot of contestation in terms of how you protect your market. I think in this way, part of the challenge of what we're seeing with the U.S. trade, U.S.-China trade tension is ramifications of how this is now playing itself out in a very diffuse international global trade arena. And the challenge for that is that trade war is happening outside of the WTO. It's happening outside of the multilateral trading regime. The second point to make is how do we deal with the non-tariff barriers? So you've got this kind of double-edged sword with regard to you've got ratification on the one hand of the Continental Free Trade Agreement, but you've also got the internal tensions that play itself out because you can see how one of the lessons we can extrapolate from the U.S.-China trade war is that it's not just about tariffs. That war is actually about the old war of tariffs, the steel, the automotive. It's not the new war. The new war is bubbling under in the U.S. trade tension, and that is digitization of trade, that is e-commerce, and that is what the tension with Huawei and 5G is all about, is how do I retain intellectual property rights of data. And data is the new oil. Who controls your data? Who has access to your data? Who controls your digital footprint? This is what's going on, and that's the big issue as well. So I think in a time where Africa is trying to expedite a continental free trade agreement, it also has to deal with these institutional challenges that are bubbling under, which also have impacts around the movement of people and so forth. The second point to make is where South Africa is now and where South Africa was in 1994, I think we've got to recognize that the continent has moved very, very fast. There are new gateways in the continent. There are new economic avenues. And we are in a kind of, a cul-de-sac at times to be able to understand how those new gateways are playing into our production spheres, our manufacturing, and how do we also don't get left behind in terms of the fourth industrial revolution and so forth. And I think this is where I want to bring in not the competition, but just the interesting footprint of countries like Turkey. We keep talking about China, we keep talking about India. I think India is a very muted country in Africa. We don't pay enough attention to India, and we don't pay enough attention to the development cooperation that India is using in terms of how it's opening up market space in the continent. China, we hear a lot about it because we need a bogeyman somewhere along the line, and that's what China does. China is both an opportunity and a threat in the way that we want to characterize the interpretation of China. But let me just give you a context of debt. We keep hearing this narrative about Chinese re-indebting African countries through the Belt Road Initiative and through the loans that are being given to African countries in terms of infrastructure development. And there's this narrative that's coming out a lot in the discourse around, China is going to be Africa's new debtor or creditor, or how you want to put it across. And somebody gave me the statistic, and I'm not sure if the figure's accurate, but I put it there, but I place it under correction, that the U.S. owes China $1.12 trillion in terms of debt. And Africa's debt in terms of the loans and when it will mature and what's currently on the books is about $86 billion. And I think that's the scale in which we're looking at what are some of the political economy questions about how Africa is being positioned in terms of global trends and narratives and issues with regard to actors like China, Turkey, not so much India, but just actors like that are being, and of course Russia, are being positioned around how you do trade. How do you actually do trade? Because it's your independent decision to do trade with everybody you want to do trade. because it's about your national economic interest. And I think that's the challenge, because the new actors have opened up the landscape. A little bit cautious to call it an Africa rising, because of how the rise has to take place, because it needs to meet the consensus around economic building, institutional building, leadership, and so forth. But I think actors like the Gulf states, the UAE, Iran, we even hear about Israel as well, who have come into the continent and are opening up market space for their corporates, for their companies, and for their interest in terms of economic diplomacy. And this is how we need to start thinking about the continent, that the continent is now becoming a very diverse and a diffuse center of economic interest for different actors. And later this year, I think Russia is going to host its first Russia-Africa summit. It held about 2 or 3 months ago the first Russia Africa parliamentary summit that took place. So I think the space is quite interesting. The challenge for many African countries is how do they navigate these different external partnerships. That's the big challenge. And for South Africa is how does it deal with other actors in the continent where it can enter into complementary economic relationships, but it also has to understand that there's competition in the market as well. Just a final point to make, Chair, and that is to understand that it's an interesting space, because the other dynamic for Africa is dealing with regional economic memberships and how you actually rationalize the overlapping membership between countries belonging to SADC, to COMESA, to EAC, to SACU, etc. And if you look at some of the trade stats that Polanyi put up, I think one of the interesting issues for South Africa is how the SACU market plays a significant and has a significant feature of South Africa's trade patterns in the region. And that's something we've got to think about in terms of that. You would have received a little policy brief that says South Africa's role in the world, a public opinion survey. Just to give you a background note, that was done in 2012 by a South African Foreign Policy Initiative, which no longer exists, but it was part of the understanding of how South Africans see foreign policy, and Polanyi will speak to that later on in terms of understanding what are the dynamics that drive foreign policy interests and understanding at the public, at the domestic public opinion level. Thank you.
I think we almost at the end of our at least of our formal presentation, and now I think let's just touch on a few of the global risks and opportunities. We know that Brexit is one of those areas, and as we sit here and discuss, there's also been quite intense discussions going on between trade negotiators from the UK and trade negotiators from the SACU countries plus Mozambique. So your BLNS, your Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, Swaziland, South Africa, and Mozambique have been engaged in very intense discussions now about negotiating a post-Brexit trade landscape between Southern Africa and the UK. I think it's important to note here that while, you know, events such as, you know, or developments such as Brexit do carry their own risks, is that they also have opportunities if they are properly identified from the South African side. The UK will be wanting to show its trade partners that it remains an open partner. It will want to show its trade partners that the free trade agreement it agrees with them will even surpass that one, equal or surpass that one of the EU, through the EU economic partnership agreements. So there are some opportunities that we do need to also identify, and I think it's important in terms of how we engage the UK in that regard. But it seems that the partners are quite close now to an agreement, at least on negotiating that post-Brexit landscape. The difficulty for the British will obviously be in the fact that it has to renegotiate hundreds of agreements, of trade agreements, that it's privy to through its membership of the EU. So as soon as it exits the EU, it has to go and renegotiate all of those trade deals. And the question is whether they have the capacity for it. If they don't have the capacity, it means that they will focus on some of their more strategic partners. And when it comes to their engagements on the continent, South Africa is one of their strategic partners. As Sanusha has touched on some of the areas around the China-US trade war, which is not only a trade war but also a tech war, and it's really a conflict over the new technologies that are emerging. It's important in this regard that as South Africa and as an African continent, is that we don't too easily get caught up in the fights of the great powers. But instead, if we good in our diplomacy, we can use our relations with the U.S. and the and China to actually meet our own interests, rather than feeling that we need to choose sides, all the time. BRICS is remains an area of interest for South Africa, particularly with the new development bank that is now operational and has its office in Johannesburg. Recent studies have shown that the countries that have received the least loans from the BRICS Development Bank, it's South Africa and Brazil. So the other BRICS countries have been have actually been more proactive in actually getting those bankable projects approved. And in the last meeting of the board of governors of the bank, South Africa and Brazil made mention that they would also be seeking to make more advantage of the new development bank. I think the Belt and Road Initiative is quite interesting from China. I mean, it's linking about 65 countries around the world, massive connectivity projects. I mean, what the Chinese have committed to is about $1 trillion U.S. dollars. Now, obviously, it can't be taken just for granted that a lot of that money will be directed towards the African continent. China has strategic partners in Central Asia, in South Asia, you know, that it will be focusing on. And in a way, we are competing with some of those countries. But what's important is that as China moves up the value chain and as it tries to produce more high-tech equipment and move away from the cheap labor structure of their economy, it's important that a lot of some of their factories that have thrived in China will be pushed out. So they'll actually be releasing some of their export capacity, and that creates opportunities along the countries in the Belt and Road. But it also means those countries need to use those loans they receive in a productive manner, so that they don't find themselves encountering debt situations because of unproductive projects. Mm. And I think the urgency is really upon the countries that are engaging with China to ensure that in their engagements that they are actually choosing the projects that are more productive, but also that they're coordinating around the regional economic communities and the AU, because the AU Agenda 2063 has 12 projects that they've articulated, which are your flagship projects. And, you know, countries on the continent could use that engagement, for instance, to finance some of those projects. The Asia-Africa Growth Corridor is also an opportunity championed by Japan, India, and also Indonesia. And these all just highlight, you know, that the continent is becoming a center for geopolitical and geoeconomic activity, and that in the manner in which we position ourselves will determine whether we use those global engagements for our own development needs. And then lastly, it's just, you know, the importance of building capacity, I think. Also, not only within the Committee on International Relations, but it goes back to the point I started with South Africa having such a large global presence in the world and having such a big presence in the country. It's important that, you know, we look towards things like research and dialogue programs on parliamentary diplomacy, so that we do have more research that is also undertaken, comparing how other parliamentary committees actually operate, what form of oversight they are able to exercise over their country's foreign policy. And as we boost, you know, the research capacity of the committee, it also gives it an opportunity to preempt some of those risks and some of those hotspots that may be developing on the continent, so that the work is not necessarily reacting to international relations, but that it's also preempting and in a way shaping events as they come. So there's a big, I think, a big role for parliamentary diplomacy. And then lastly, it's just to really, about this, you know, this survey. I mean, I think the importance of this survey that Sanusha circulated is that I think more of these surveys will also help the work of the committee, where, you know, we have regular surveys, elite surveys, but also, you know, more open surveys, which really show what are South Africans thinking about foreign policy. And that goes with closing that gap between the large footprint we have globally and the large interest that is in South Africa with, you know, to what extent does the public actually understand the importance of international relations, understand the importance of South Africa to be engaged in international relations. And I think that's, you know, that's quite important, and that if this survey was conducted in 2013, I think it's the perfect time now to again be supporting such surveys. And I think on the survey, let me let Sanusha have the closing words.
Thank you. I think to give you a bit of a context, the survey really gives insight into how trade investment are priorities in 2013 in terms of the sample that was surveyed, partly because I think it tells us how ordinary South Africans view the role that the government must play in foreign policy in terms of what role and responsibility South Africa has in the continent and how important that is in terms of helping, assisting other African countries with their economic development as well. And I think the point that Talani makes is that if we have to take the same questions today and put it out there and look at how perhaps attitudes have shifted in terms of what has been domestic shifts in our political, economic landscape, socio-economic landscape, it will be very interesting to extrapolate some key messages that we need to take forward in terms of what are some of the issues that have now prevailed in our society. And that is why I think the survey is a good primer in terms of how are South Africans even perceiving themselves in relation to the world, and how much of that perception of ourselves is rooted in the way that it conforms to the policy domain and the policy issues that we want to put into place at a governmental level and incorporates the issues that are coming up from the ground. And so With that said, I just want to add a last point on the U.S.-China trade war and, of course, just the future of BRICS, the Belt Road Initiative, and the Africa Growth Africa-Asia Growth Corridor. I think we're seeing a very interesting dynamic emerge within the discourse of security and development. That if you're looking at the Belt Road Initiative, if you're looking at the at where even in the context of BRICS, if you're looking at Brexit, there's an interesting dynamic emerging of how development is becoming securitized. And to a large extent, this is what we have to deal with. There's a very interesting book written by a professor, Guy Standing, who talks about a precariat that exists in every society in the world because they are marginalized, they are on the periphery, and they're not getting access to the benefits, and how that precariat impacts on the domestic, but the implications this has for international foreign policy, bilateral, multilateral relations. And I think we can't ignore that securitization issue and how that securitization issue plays a role in the context of development, but also in the way that some of the actions and some of the issues place particular risks on governments who have to start thinking about security and development within the same context of the narrative. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Naidoo and Dr. Philani for your presentation. Next time when you present, you look at me. Don't look at the audience because they are presenting to me. And surely you would be fascinated to look at this beautiful face. For the duration of your presentation, so that also you are not disturbed. We welcome the presentation. It was very lengthy and informative. We take it as an eye opener for us as a committee. And we are not going to commit to the presentation because it was not for us to commit. But it's safe to say that some elements of the presentation, which you have highlighted, it is part of the agenda of this portfolio, as new as it is. But we know exactly what SAPTA is and what should be done and when that should be done. And we interrogated it, fortunately, not long ago in our orientation at DERCO. We interrogated that, and also we are looking forward to the establishment of that agency. So we are on track. By the way, I was sitting here whispering to our content advisor that this presentation, it is as if you were part of our last week's session and orientation at DERCO. It is in fact articulating exactly some of the things that we have we've raised as the portfolio committee. However, I'm going to allow members of the portfolio to interrogate the presentation, but we did not say in terms of trade wars between China and the U.S., then we must leverage the opportunity to the best of the advantage of the country as you wish, that we should not take sides. We don't want to be opportunists as well as a country. Once the trade wars, people must resolve their issues of trade wars there, you know, without involving us, because we've got our own problems already in the international space. With the current, I don't know, but it's not xenophobia, developments in Gauteng and so on. So that is what we are focusing on. South Africans are being evacuated in Nigeria as things stand, and that is our focus and our preoccupation. So trade wars they are for big guys. We're just small fishes in a bigger ocean as the country. So that's not our preoccupation. So we've got a lot in our plate. The so-called xenophobia, which is in fact criminal elements and thuggery, in our view, is what we should focus on. Interesting developments are happening in the continent. Botswana has deported some Nigerians, this thing stands because of these criminalities and so on. So I think that's our preoccupation as the committee, as much as well we are avoiding the media space, but we took note of all those happenings. As and when the time is right, we do under statements and voice our opinions as a portfolio. And we want to keep it at that pace. So, honorable members, I trust that you made notes. I saw honorable Chief taking his pen when figures were mentioned, and I was like, oh my goodness, there comes the trouble. Once you mention figures, you must know that someone will be triggered because he likes figures a lot. So we can sit in this room until the next day because of figures don't tally. Ne? So Honorable Bergman, you are the first. Honorable Nkosi, the second. Honorable Msane, Honorable Mbanza. Is that all? Because I'm not going to allow people who are going to be triggered by other people's inputs to speak. I'm going to take that round of hands, and then I will allow the team to respond, and then I close. Thank you.
Chair, thanks very much. I must say that I would have been more impressed had we scheduled Durko to come and present to us because of what we had found last time. So for me, it's almost like the case of Nero fiddling while Rome is burning. But I must just say that I'm comforted that you and I are on the same page as always, that, you know, when it comes to big trade wars, such as China versus America, we must be very careful how we place ourselves and where we place ourselves. But I urge anyone who's on this committee to get this book called The Continental Shift. And for the last 5 years, it's Kevin Bloom and Richard Poplack. For the last 5 years, Chair, I've been speaking about China in China in South Africa and China in Africa. And it was interesting that, and the staff would remember that at one stage China gave $16 billion to Africa. And the deputy minister at the time said, no, it's just a present. And I said, there's no such thing as just a present. You know, we talk about the Silk Road, we talk about what happens, and how's the Ward Council in an area such as Modderfontein, where they were going to build a CBD, and the Premier announced this huge announcement, and everyone was excited in Alexandria because they thought that we'd get labour projects. And little did they know, and it's exactly as if you read in this book, is that when there's developments from certain countries, we've been a victim of colonialism. And we must make sure that we protect ourselves from being a victim of anything similar in the future. Because what happens, what is the experience of these authors, is that they go to different countries and they see that a country like China comes to that country, wins a tender, and before you know it, it's actually Chinese individuals that are actually working on those projects with a handful of residents from the local communities. Now, I think that our foreign policy must be influenced internally first, except the problem is we historically focused. So we carry on our loyalties, we carry on focusing on what was in the past, and we're not looking far enough into the future. So it's always good to hear the presentations, but I think, you know, that we must not have China downplayed as not a threat to what happens on our continent with the likes of BRICS and et cetera, et cetera. So I just ask that the two authors please read Continental Shift and just understand what can become of South Africa if we're not very cautious.
Thank you, Jefferson. It's just a economic interventions on our side. My understanding is that what we do in the African continent buttresses something. So we go to or we find projects in the African continent because we want to buttress peace initiatives and we want to buttress conflict resolution. And the growing scholarship that indicates that our model I'm just saying that there's growing scholarship that indicates that our model of intervention, largely based on exporting the GNU experience, unravels as soon as we leave or as soon as the social and economic features of those countries in conflict resurface, so that the GNU, while it is a good model, it does not hold for each and every situation in the continent. That leaves our economic intervention, our interventions through the African Renaissance, as a stopgap measure, not really as a sustainable thing that ensures that those that are in conflict actually engage in processes to ensure lasting peace. That's the first comment. The second comment really is in relation to geopolitics and the threats that we face. My sense is that the geopolitical landscape in the continent itself has changed. The agendas are no longer, in my view, informed by the sovereignty of the individual components of those geopolitical countries, including the sovereignty of the geopolitical setup themselves, but there is an insertion, if you will, or an influence that largely comes from these world powers that are at war with each other, be it the Soviet, Russia, be it the US, be it now Japan, Israel, etc. And with time, these geopolitical, economic, and political setups will erode the essence of what we understand by sovereignty.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is, what is the quantum of damage that foreign aid does to South Africa? And then what are the dangers or risks that the African continent exposes itself with regards to international e-commerce taking over the African continent? And what plans does Africa have, maybe with the AU, to develop our own technology so that we slowly move away from the dependency of China and the Americans? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. No, Chair, I'll just make an observation. I think we really appreciate the presentation. I think, as you have said, it's an eye-opener, very informative. And I think it's going to assist us to shape our thinking going forward. The area that I've liked very much, Chair, was the issue of the creation of this agency, which is part of the bill. The area where it talks about the role that it will be playing in domestic landscape. Because we were having a problem with the ARF as it stands now. That is outward looking. It doesn't take into account the interest of the country. It's assisting countries outside South Africa. And we were told that we can't change it because it's how it is legislated. So I think with this one, if we fast track the issue of the bill, I think it will then be a change in terms of the paradigm. It will look both the external and also internal interest of our countries. Then the last question, Chair, you talk in your presentation about building capacity with the International Relations Committee, and you highlight the issues of research and other issues. But what I want to find out, how do you envisage that taking place? In what form? That capacity, you know, whether it's a research to the committee. But also, as the Chair was saying, we really appreciate it, but at this point in time, we can't make any commitment. But I think it's a good way of starting the relationship going forward. Thank you, Chair.
The main, it's more of comments, but then there's nothing much.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members, for your comments and inputs on our presentation. As you rightly pointed out, Chair, there are comments, and I will just take a few of the questions in terms of some of my impressions and views with regard to external actors in the continent. I think the question of China undoubtedly has to be looked at in a very non-partisan way. I think we have to think about China as not just an actor that falls within particular narratives, but rather what is the impact of China as China itself begins to exert its own influence on the global architecture of the international system. And let me just point out that what makes, I duly note the point that we shouldn't get involved as South Africa in this trade tension between the two countries. But just to make the point as well about how it forms part of the intrinsic nature of what's going on in the international system today, that if you look at China and the U.S. and these tensions, what's very interesting is that China is very much part of the world trading system. And it becomes part of that space in terms of how do we assert our independent foreign policy, our decision-making, and I think it comes to the point of sovereignty as well that was raised by one of the colleagues earlier. And I think to a large extent for me, the challenge of continental shift is that the continental shift is constantly in motion. It's not static. And that we have to constantly be able to, with the ultimate resources and as much as possible, be able to understand how that continental shift doesn't remain static. And I did see the book. I read parts of the book, and I enjoyed parts of the book. But I've also read other books that talk about other narratives. And how do you bring all of this together in terms of what's going on? And how do we keep a pulse point on understanding where these continental shifts are taking place? There's not just one shift. There are many shifts. And there are many things that are taking place simultaneously within the continent. And how do you get the AU to be front and center with regard to understanding how to structure external partnerships? What are the key drivers for African Union Agenda 2063? And how you get those resources in there? I would basically try and understand this in terms of how we align issues with regard to where we want to be. And I take very much the point that it's about our domestic interests and how our national interests are being shaped by the way we articulate our foreign policy perspectives. So I think on the China space, I think there's so many competing narratives that are taking place in terms of what Polani was talking about earlier, and that is understanding the constant motion of research and what research means and how to understand the impacts this have. With regard to the questions in terms of e-commerce and the impact, I think, on Africa, it's very important that we do develop those technologies, that we do develop the kinds of e-commerce companies that are able to define and also create ownership of data that links back to us. Because right now, I think what India is doing in the WTO will have very, very prolific effects on this ownership space and how data is being controlled. And more importantly, we're living in a gig economy, an economy that's controlled by these multiplicities of how economic transactions are taking place. And to my mind, I think that how this plays out within the multilateral is very important, because it does have the levels in which the multilateral processes and the multilateral ways in which power is being defined has to be recognized in the context of policy making and decision making as well. And then finally, I think on the issue of the AU and technology, I'm not sure. I will have to go do a little bit more reading on, in terms of that. But we have a colleague who is very much involved in the fourth industrial revolution research, and he has presented a few papers on this, and he has investigated the AU's positioning on technology as well. And then, of course, for me, agency is very much part of structure, and it's important that agency is defined in the way that you structurally want to pursue issues and so forth. So I think to a large extent, we have to have duality in the way we see things as well. Both at the domestic level, but then how does the domestic shape the international and the international shape the domestic? Thank you.
I won't repeat the areas that Sanush has touched on, but one thing I'll pick up on is the basic idea of the model on post-conflict resolution, and this idea of a government of national unity, and how in recent years there has been more criticism towards this model, and the critique has kind of gone in a way that South Africa is looking too narrowly at this idea of a government of national unity, using its experience and exporting it on the continent. I think what's important is that, yes, we take that on board, but I think one of the key things that are going to remain critical in terms of South Africa's international engagement is the idea of dialogue. And maybe it's not so much about going in with a preconceived idea of a type of a national structure that should be formed when it comes to resolving conflicts, but in forms of being a facilitator of dialogue, so that local stakeholders can actually resolve their political challenges, and that they come up with the structures, supported of course by South Africa, but that they come up with the structures that are sustainable and that can outlive those peace agreements. I mean, there's various studies which shows that after signing a peace accord, the rate of actually going back to conflict. And one of the issues there is what is happening post-conflict. It's not enough to mediate and get, sides to actually agree to peace. But there has to be an incentive after that gets the country moving, that gets the country focused on development issues. And that's why what we're almost talking about is a whole of government approach, but also not just whole of government. In some of those post-conflict countries, we need to be also looking at the economic opportunity that is actually realized. And economy and peace, there's a clear linkage there, because if you get sides to stop fighting, but then afterwards there's no economic activity, there's no prospect of getting employment, then some will say, hey, it was profitable for me when I had a gun, and right now I'm not seeing any prospects for the country. So it's important, I think, to go in with an open mind, allow the local stakeholders to design some of the peace arrangements, but it's also equally important for the country
to be actively involved beyond the conflict. And that could be also involving, some of our, organizations such as your Development Bank of Southern Africa, involving your IDCs, and let them work with private sector also to try and find and look for bankable projects within the continent in areas that are actually coming out of conflict. I think if you look at the attitude of countries like India and China when they looked at Africa, is that whereas many were looking at Africa as a place of poverty, no opportunity, and so forth, I think we need to understand that just 30 years ago, countries like China and India were among the highest recipients of development aid in the world. And within a relatively short space of time, they've turned it around from being among the poorest countries in the world. So they understand that there is opportunity presented by solving socio-economic challenges. And that's where I think South Africa then will at least should seek to be more engaged in future. Because also if it doesn't get engaged in those areas, other actors come. So South Africa engages in getting sides to stop fighting, and then other actors come and actually scoop up the economic opportunities that are presented. So it is something that I think we need to factor in. And then just on sovereignty, I think it's also important to think not only about national sovereignty, but how through the sub-regional or how through the regional economic communities and through the African Union, we can gradually move towards an idea not just of national sovereignty, but of continental sovereignty, where we have a sovereignty over our maritime and continental space, and where when foreign actors engage with the continent, they engage with a more unified continent in terms of priorities of development. Doesn't mean all the countries agree on all matters. But on those matters and those projects they agree on, one would like to see, I think, more cohesion in getting foreign actors to invest in projects that they've already agreed to at a sub-regional and at a continental level. And then lastly, in terms of how, we envision, some of this capacity building, I think it's through partnerships, like this. Resources are scarce all around, both within government and outside of government. But I think where you have such interactions between the research community and the committee, where institutions such as ours, for instance, commit to coming, three, four times, a year, maybe once a quarter, or, to whatever the needs of the committee are, but, where we ensure that the research that we are involved in does not just get consumed by the research community, but it's also consumed by the members of the committee, but that is also consumed also by stakeholders within DIRCO. So that I think if you have that environment where the policy makers and the researchers are actually working closer together, then the research becomes more relevant because it speaks to the priorities of the people who are actually doing the work. And it's not just hypothetical, questions that have no relevance in the real world. So I think if we can, close that gap, and find ways of partnering and sharing resources, I think that will be one way to ensure that we build capacity within the committee, but also to ensure that the research that happens outside of the committee does have a relevance to the work that the committee is actually doing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mthembu. Honorable Ngozi, we are still in a meeting.
Yeah,
and the meeting is still in progress. So, so I can assure you, Dr. Mthembu, that in this committee we do have capacity, even in terms of research. That's why we are ahead in terms of information as well. So that capacity is there, and they are indeed working very closely with the portfolio, the officials of Parliament in this committee. I can say with confidence that they are the best. Even the research capacity which they have is on another level. And no member of the committee would say they are dissatisfied with that. Mrs. Naidu, I really don't know what's wrong with China when asserting itself in the global space, because as things stand, China is the second biggest economy in the world. And this perception and this narrative that China wants to assert itself in Africa only, for me, it is quite fallacious. It is quite fallacious that it is the very same China that rescued America and the U.S. at some point during recession, when there was no one to rescue those big boys there. So it can't be that Africa will be seen as victims of China. Not unless you convince me otherwise through your research, but the tone of the presentation and the responses begins to suggest that China is in actual fact or kind of bullying Africa. Everyone wants a piece of China in the world, not only Africa. And we, some of the countries in Africa are developmental states. So we need that capacity and that path. And with the BRICS, you know, on our side, and the BRICS Development Bank, I think we will go far. Leave the IMF and the World Bank and other banks. Let's talk about the BRICS Development Bank and what it can do for African countries in particular. Because there, your infrastructure won't be at stake. I can tell that much. We once learned about an invisible hand of Adam Smith, once believed that government must be run like a Pty Ltd, and that alone had dire implications to some of governments, especially in the European countries. So that invisible hand in China, I don't think exists. But with the IMF and the World Bank, that invisible hand is there. But when we have time, we are going to engage, and I will expand on what I'm saying. Otherwise, it's like that. I wish we had time so that we are able to reflect on some of the things that you have read. But time is against us. We have two presentations today. I hope that, honorable members, your questions are responded to. Honorable Msan, are you satisfied with the response? For a change, you are satisfied. Thank you very much. Meaning this team is very good. You are satisfied with the responses. Yeah, today is another day. Thank you very much, Dr. Mthembu and Ms. Naidu or Mrs. Naidu, for your presentation. From time to time, we'll invite you, hoping you won't get tired. Okay, thank you very much. Are you ready, advocate? You can be recused now. You can come in front with your presentation. Or you speak, yeah.
Thank you. No. The German guy sitting on that side. You don't mind being between two guys.
Which German guy? You were obviously the German guy.
Are you?
What German?
Consul guy, man.
Oh, is he the consul from? Is he the German? What's that name? I don't know.
Where must you go?
At 12 o'clock, I've got a call. That's fine, I'll just have to buy you to the house, that's okay. I'm going to see something. I'm going to meet a German person.
He always comes to the meeting. That elderly gentleman with a grey name, I speak. Can you not know him?
No.
You know everybody?
I don't know him. Was that interesting? I missed half of it. It sounded like they were talking a lot about that one book.
Mr. Bergman mentioned the book that members should read. And then the presenter responded that she did read parts of it.
Is that what you were saying, that there's lots of other
things? There's more other things that can be also taken into consideration.
Is this more questions?
Yeah. What's your meeting?
No, I didn't meet him. I don't want to sit on his lap.
Because
you know what, I'll sit in this chair because I have to leave at 12 anyway. I don't want to watch
sugar. Okay.
Thank you.
Advocate, if you are ready, you can start with the proposition.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and honourable members. I'm Sandhya Devet. I'm Chief State Law Advisor in DOCO, and we have been responsible for bringing the bill to this stage. I want to also say that we have been working as a very good team with the parliamentary legal advisor, Mr. Nazim Genzani, and with Mr. Raya Williams from the Department of Justice. Of course, we have been working very closely with Mrs. Nayo Musala, the content advisor of the Portfolio Committee. So to all of these colleagues, I am extremely grateful to have the opportunity to introduce them and to have them here today. We are also joined by Mr. Nyambi from our Deputy Minister office, and also Mr. Franz, who is the Parliamentary Officer. Madam, we have a presentation that's quite lengthy, but it deals with, and I need your guidance, it deals with the process status. In other words, how did we come to this place, and how what happened in the last Parliament. Also, then we went into what was the rationale for the bill. We spent some time on the contents of the bill. We would highlight the new clauses added by the Portfolio Committee, the previous Portfolio Committee, and then also highlight the implications of the bill for DIRCO and government and the way forward, in other words, what the departments are currently doing. So if that is fine with you that we go into this detail, I'm ready to be guided, Madam.
Advocate, I want to advise that we leave the history because we're here now, and you know, Gramsci always guides our thinking. The old can refuse to die for the new to emerge. So that's where we are. So you can deal with the rationale, the new clauses, and this particular clause, which caused some confusion at some point, and unpack the clause and give us your legal advice in it and so on, if there's a need for that. And then deal with the implications and the way forward. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for your guidance, Madam Chair. So I would start with the rationale of the bill. Thank you so much. I have such a competent colleague here for support. I'm so grateful. What we want to highlight is that currently South Africa doesn't have a legislative mechanism to optimally support the mandate of the department and government to achieve the country's foreign policy objectives. This was an important driver for looking into what needs to be done in order to get the optimal benefits from our foreign policy. We acknowledge the fact that the international relations are executed in a global environment, and we operate within diverse legal systems that are different from the national domestic legislative context. So that was also a very important matter. South Africa's representation abroad includes a mix of career diplomats within the DIRCO, employees from other departments, appointees from outside the public service, not only on heads of mission level but also on other levels. At present, the management of the day-to-day administrative situations are very challenging. The current foreign service system. Currently, we are confined within the legislation aimed at regulating the public service here in South Africa. And of course, that leads to a number of concerns that have been raised by the Auditor General. We also have done extensive research on other foreign services, and we came to be noted that the majority of foreign services sit as legislative frameworks through which they administer and manage the foreign services of their governments, and it is through which the operations are regulated. For the most effective execution of international relations, a foreign service therefore needs to be supported by an appropriate legislative framework that is flexible enough to address the challenges posed at an operational level in missions. And Madam, you would have now, or honourable members, you would have seen the developments in recent days, and also the fact that there will be evacuations considered. So all of that is a fluid situation, and you need to have systems and legislative inflation in place that can actually assist you. Then, as you rightly say, I will dwell on clause 2, and here I trust that the parliamentary legal advisers that provided legal advice on this matter and the state law advisers from Justice will assist in explaining the difficulty with clause 2. Clause 1 is of course on the definitions. Clause 2, it clarifies the application of the bill. And it states where there's a conflict between the provisions of other legislation and the bill, this act will apply. Now, I don't know whether I should pause there and perhaps ask the parliamentary legal advisor who provided written legal advice on this matter to come in here, please, madam.
Yes, I will.
Good morning, members and honourable chairperson. My name is Nathan Jamada from Parliamentary Legal Services. Chairperson, the clause 2 that my colleague is referring to is titled in the Foreign Service Bill. The third clause is titled Application of the Act, Chairperson. And I'd just like to read it out for honourable members' benefit. It reads as follows. Application of the Act, Clause 2, Subsection 1 reads, subject to provisions of this Act, the conditions of service of members of the Foreign Service must be governed by the law governing that employee's conditions of service. Then Clause 2.2 reads as follows, Chair. When this Act conflicts with the provisions of the Public Service Act or any other legislation, and it is not possible to read the conflicting provisions as complementary to one another, this Act must prevail. So this was the contentious clause, Chairperson, which basically, in essence, assumes that or provides that members of the public service or members of the foreign service who fall under the Public Service Act would still be regulated in terms of that act, even if they were seconded or deployed in the Foreign Service Office. And they would still be regulated by the public service. However, if there was a conflict between the provisions of the Public Service Act and the provisions of this bill in relation to work relating to the Foreign Service, this bill would prevail. And in our legal opinion, Chairperson, we alluded to the fact that this is not an animal, it's not a matter that is unheard of in legislation drafting. It's called a dimming provision. And it has been applied in legislation drafting. The courts have also ruled that such a provision is not a rule that is offensive in legal terms and can be used in legislation drafting. We provided a number of constitutional court and high court decisions where such a rule, Chairperson, has been established by the courts, that there was nothing offensive in law with a provision such as that one. Chairperson, that is the essence of the contention as it related to that section. Thank you.
Thank you, very much for that. And that I must say that in the select committee, it was explained at length by both legal advisers from Parliament and from Justice as to exactly how this is an important aspect to be included in the bill. And just to emphasize that this bill is a specific, very specific legislation for a specific matter, and it does not intend to amend or to exclude any of the existing public service regulations or acts that are applicable on employees who will serve in the Foreign Service. Then clause 3, Madam, that is where we define what the Foreign Service would be. And this includes all South African missions and those that serve in missions that are accredited to foreign states, to the foreign state for the period of their service abroad. It was very important for us to have a provision to say all those that are have been accredited, because we had a very fragmented system where several departments would serve at a mission and still act as if they are representing their individual departments. So the Foreign Service will aim to consolidate and have one a mission that represents the whole of South Africa and not just individual departments. What is it that it will what is the Foreign Service? As I said, all transferred officials, including the heads of mission. The Foreign Service, what is it supposed to do? And this is the mandate. For the first time, there is a legislative mandate on what the Foreign Service is supposed to do, and that is to promote and advance the international relations and cooperation of the Republic in an effective, coherent, and comprehensive manner. DIRCO will be responsible for conducting and coordinating the international relations and cooperation of the Republic at the bilateral, regional, and multilateral levels through the Foreign Service. DIRCO would also be responsible for the implementation of the Foreign Service policy and for promoting the Republic's national interests and values in line with the foreign policy. Then it also provides for the Foreign Service to be managed by DIRCO. And in this regard, it is saying that the department will be responsible, and this is actually for the first time just dotting down what the department is already been doing. And then also strengthen this in a legislative mandate. Of course, DIRCO is responsible for administering all foreign representation in South Africa. That is the previous speaker that talk about the very big footprint of foreign representatives in South Africa, and it is indeed, as he rightly said, it is an extraordinary number of missions and organizations that are accredited here. DIRCO is also responsible to lead the coordination and alignment of the Republic's international relations between all three spheres of government. We render protocol services to designated foreign and national dignitaries as prescribed already and will be put into regulations. It's also responsible to render consular services in line with the guidelines for the provision of consular services. Consular services is a very important public face of the department and government, and is assisting nationals abroad and entities that run into problems and do a lot more than that legalization of documents for serving abroad, etc. DIRCO is also, Madam, as you would have noted from last week's engagement, the custodian of international agreements to which the Republic is a party, as well as the national reports submitted in accordance with international obligations, and to render legal advice to government on specifically international law matters. It is also responsible to conduct all diplomatic communications between the Republic and foreign states, international organizations and entities. And this is an important aspect because we have seen a proliferation of communications between missions and various departments when they in a manner that is not always constructive. And then, of course, we perform any other functions required for the effective management and administration of the Foreign Service. Now, the requirements to serve as as members of the Foreign Service was one of the provisions that was indeed changed by the, or amended by the previous portfolio committee to strengthen the requirements. It says now very clearly that the head of the national department, say for instance the Department of Home Affairs, the head meaning the Director General, needs now to write and notify the Director General of DIRCO of an employee who has been approved from that national department to be transferred to the South African mission. This was due to the fact that we had situations where an official will knock on the door of the mission and say, "I'm here." And that of course doesn't bode well for proper administration. A member of the Foreign Service are also required, and it may not take up its position at the South African mission at such time as it has, he or she has successfully completed the prescribed mandatory training requirements. He or she has met the prescribed requirements for transfer, which is a number of administrative matters that need to be completed. He or she has obtained a security clearance as issued by the competent authority in South Africa, and the approval of the transfer has been granted by the Director General. This will considerably strengthen the coherent administration, effective administration of the Foreign Service. Then clause 5, I just want to just get to my page. Clause 5 was also amended by the previous portfolio committee, and it acknowledged the fact that the president is responsible in terms of the constitution to appoint heads of mission to manage and administer the mission. This clause then says clearly that the heads of mission will be under the authority of the Director General. That is in line with the transfer contract that Heads of Mission signed at the moment, and it will act on the instructions of the relevant senior manager responsible for a particular mission. And that was also due to the fact that we had some problems in the line of authority of who is whose boss. So that now clarifies that. And then it also provides criteria that the President may take into account when approving an ambassador's name, and that is that all heads of mission must be fit and proper persons. They may have knowledge and skills and experience and must reflect broadly the diversity of South Africa. Now that clause, the broadly diversity of South Africa, the background to that is also that we need to have a mixture of female gender balance. We have to have a mixture of youth and perhaps not so youthful anymore, and that was the way in which I think it was quite elegantly resolved by the portfolio committee at the time. Clause 6 is a very important clause because that deals now for the first time, it makes a clear distinction between what is meant by recall of members of the foreign service and then other types of recall that are practiced in diplomatic relations. For instance, quite recently, just an example, there were talk that Nigeria has recalled its ambassador. It is a kind of protest. So when we want to do the same, there are a number of public service aspects that would make it very difficult to do that instantly, because this, if you register your displeasure with a particular government, you want to do it immediately. So we have now made a clear distinction between when there is an issue of misconduct, and that, of course, will follow the normal Labour Relations Act and Public Service Act provisions, and then these other types of cases, or even where a South African ambassador or colleague diplomat would be declared persona non grata. Usually that means the government doesn't want you anymore there, and you get 48 hours, sometimes even less, to get out of the country. So this now regulates that eventuality. Then Clause 7 deals specifically with the Diplomatic Academy, because we in DACA realize how essential training for all the government departments is to understand what the unique role is of being a representative of South Africa abroad. So this now, also for the first time, provides that the prescribed mandatory training for members of the Foreign Service, it provides, it will provide, the Academy will provide any training or cause such training to be provided to employees and to members of the Foreign Service. It will be conducting and causing such tests and examination as is needed, and it will also issue the diplomas and certificates. They are already accredited, and the Academy is already accredited, but this will then be formalized, and it will be issued to persons who have passed such examination. So this is quite a formidable task. Clause on the establishment of the coordination and other mechanisms. This is where the department would then have this, the minister will have this forum where she may establish consultative, coordinating and other mechanisms as she deemed necessary for the effective execution of the bill that she may create. This is also intended to formalize the current structure, the coordinating forum for international relations, CIFA. It's called CIFA, and it's meeting next week, where all three spheres of government, that's local government, all the provinces, and all the national departments will come together and to discuss international relations matters, and discuss appropriate protocol-related issues, and establish a good working relationship. This mechanism that is already there is, of course, in line with what is contemplated in the International Relations Framework, Intergovernmental Relations Framework Act, the several departments come together and talk about issues of common interest. Clause 9 is the one on and this is a very important one, is actually on the immovable assets. Now here the previous portfolio committee also assisted a great deal, because they actually went at one time specifically to Namibia, where they could see exactly what is happening with properties that are not properly disposed of when they are not used. So the Clause 9 now provides the minister with powers, and it's important to note, to acquire, manage, dispose, lease and rent the immovable assets of DIRCO within and outside the Republic. Now, this means that where we own a state property for a mission, this can now be disposed of. DIRCO has already, in terms of a delegation, been handling the acquiring, management, lease and rent of immovable assets. But the disposal aspect was always with public works. So this is now gives the responsibility to the minister and the power, but of course that power can only be exercised in consultation with the Minister of Public Works and the Minister of Finance. Properties that are currently not used is also marked as fruitless expenditure. So it would be a great relief if there could be movement on this particular purpose. Then what will inform a decision to dispose of immovable assets? Firstly, it must be in the interest of the effective management of the Foreign Service, and it must be benefit for the Republic in order to achieve the best functional, financial, economic, social return or other benefits from the disposal of immovable assets. So there will be a study conducted to ensure that what we are doing is in fact economically wise. Then we in Clause 10, it's stipulated that any person, and this has to do with LRPs, LLPs are locally recruited personnel that South Africa employs at the missions abroad. And there we now, the bill clearly stipulates that when there's a South African citizen that are actually allowed to work in terms of the laws of a foreign state, that person may be employed as locally recruited personnel at the South African mission. So if South Africa, if there is a South African that are actually not allowed to work in a particular country, perhaps it's just a visa for a visit or a visa with a restriction on employment, this will now regulate that, because our experience has also shown that we have problems in this regard. Clause 11 would provide for codes and directives that the minister may make to assist with the proper management and administration of the foreign service. There's also a later a clause that deals with the regulations that the minister may make. Clause 12 is, I think, a standard, almost standard in all legislation of this nature, where it regulates the delegation of powers by the minister to the director general. Clause 13 is also a first for the Foreign Service, and I think perhaps for in government, if you look at it so specifically, this was also a proposal that was worked on very extensively by the Portfolio Committee. It now says that there will be offences created, and this would include the offences committed abroad. Making false representations, if you see sometimes there would be a presentation or somebody would make or give the impression that they are actually representing South Africa, and that person can then also be charged, would also constitute an offence and be charged, and then also the misuse of state resources, and then importantly acts that bring the Republic in disrepute. These activities or these actions have been now classified as offences. 14, as I say, is dealing with the minister's power to make regulations and provide for the. And then clause 15 is the traditional clause that provides for the short title and the commencement of the bill. Madam, I've already spoken to what the Portfolio Committee has highlighted. I don't think I need to repeat that, so we will move on to the next part, the implications of the Foreign Service Bill for DIRCO. The department is very, very clear that there will be implications for its operations that are currently unlegislated. We would be required to now, for the first time, comply and take full responsibility for the obligations attributed to it, and the Auditor General will most certainly also use the bill when it is enacted, the Act, to measure our standards of operation. The daily activities will also be impacted by the provisions of the bill. DIRCO needs to develop regulations, codes and directives for the bill to be ready for implementation as soon as possible after the signature by the President. And if I say DIRCO, this will of course not be done in isolation. All line departments that have been consulted in this process will also of course be part of that process. What we have identified as things that need to be done on an urgent basis is, firstly, there need to be a decision on what would be the prescribed mandatory training that are required, and of course this will also not replace the job-specific or post-specific training requirements that, for instance, the police will have, or defence will have, or Home Affairs will have. This is mandatory training in relation to the foreign policy and foreign service as such. Then, of course, we need to have a diplomatic passport policy, which has been identified. We need to formalize the guidelines for the provision of consular services. It is a document that is alive, but I think it needs some urgent resuscitation and perhaps a little bit of a heart transplant. Then, of course, we need to have now clear regulations on the acquisition, management, and disposal of foreign immovable properties. This will be done, of course, in cooperation with Public Works, who have already in place certain regulations that we would, in fact, be able to use as is, with the necessary adjustment for properties that are in a foreign jurisdiction. There's a number of HR policies that must actively be converted into regulations, as it will be pertain to all departments that serve abroad, and that is part of the negotiations of the Foreign Service Code that needs to be revised. There needs to be regulations for the enhanced coordination of South Africa's international engagement. There is such a document available. That document now needs to be translated into a regulation form. And then the training requirements that will be required for both heads of missions and all members of the Foreign Service is another matter that we need to urgently look at. Of course, we have identified the need within DIRCO and government to internalize the implications of this legislative mandate, because we are venturing into a totally new era for the Foreign Service, and this is an important matter that you really need to get a grip on. So there's been a task team that has been working for quite a while, but it has been re-established when we saw that the bill has been adopted by the National Assembly. So it was re-established with a refocus on the urgency of the matter. It is led by the Director General, and it will have various subcommittees that are work on specifically, for instance, the Academy, Protocol, Consular, and so on. And also there will have to be an assessment of the functionality of the organizational structure to be fit for purpose. That is unavoidable to bring the code into shape to actually give effect to the provisions of the bill, and also to bear the obligations and responsibilities that come with this bill. There will be an awareness campaign within DIRCO, and also then awareness campaign for all national, provincial, and local governments. I know that the Deputy Minister has already arranged for roadshows to be conducted in various provinces that will highlight several issues, and that will include the Foreign Service Bill. Adam, that is the presentation that we have prepared. We are ready to answer any questions or give any further clarification. Thank you very much, and thank you also to the team that assisted me here. Thanks.
Yeah, I am honorable chief. Yeah. Even before the advocate could say amen, your hand is up. Is the figures on this document? Thank you very much, advocate, for a comprehensive presentation. Honorable chief, I have not even said, members, it's your opportunity to raise questions and engage on this. But your hand is up. Wow. Okay. You are number one, Honorable Chief. Number two, Honorable Nkosi. Number three, Honorable Bergman. Number four, Honorable Mushwe. Number five, Honorable... what? Mbanza, Honorable Msano, you follow him. You are going to be the last.
No
problem. Yes. Thank you. In that order.
Thanks, Chair. Yeah, see, Chair, Walala Wasala. So you're getting first. Thank you, Chair. Chair, I must say this, that during our orientation and interaction with DIRCO officials last week, as well as with the officials when they came to our meeting, a point of contention always was either a hindrance or a solution was the FSB and the lack of that. Now, what I like about this chairperson is that exactly what the committee was complaining about, the FSB addresses all of that. And I went through both the report by the Honorable Maku from the Senate committee, as well as the submission from the stakeholders. And I couldn't understand when I read through the legal report and the definition as to why they had an issue around it. And I think again today it was clearly explained as to why and what the purpose of it. Now, having listened to all of the chairperson, I have a concern as to why they raised those two concerns on those two clauses. Because clearly, either they were not properly informed about the explanation we received, because to me it makes common sense if you listen to the explanation we received. And I believe, Chairperson, that in the short term that we are here, for us to make sure that this department is going to be working more effectively, that we should be reviving this bill, ASAP, if we want to become progressive. And Chairperson, when I read that the final recommendation is that to prevent any further delay, that if we are going to also consider those two clauses that were in so-called dispute or inquiry, we're going to have to start the entire thing, as opposed to us having it revived as is. So I want to say, Chairperson, that that is what this committee should be considering. And like I said, I'm progressive, Chairperson, because there's only two issues in this entire bill, because the portfolio committee at the last time, although they approved it, as if those two clauses that were an issue. And right now what we should be focusing on, whether those two clauses are relevant or not, instead of just wasting our time trying to do the entire bill again. And like you said, sometimes for some people who progress, we can't have the young death story. So I don't want us to go back in time. I'd rather be progressive and just consider whether those two clauses are relevant enough that we should be considering, or we ask for the bill to be revived as is. Thank you, Chair. I made a proposal, Chair.
I mean, there's lots of proposals that you are making. I think you mentioned about three or four proposals. Focus on the bill or revive it. Consider two clauses in dispute or whatever. So be explicit when you are putting a proposal so that it's not difficult for me to summarize a proposal for the rest of the team.
Thanks. Chair, I'm proposing that we revive this bill.
Public Works should be responsible for our our assets overseas and abroad. And I think this is all the more reason why we should get this Foreign Services Bill introduced as soon as possible. I think whatever steps that we can take at this stage to speed up the process, because we've done everything already and we've laid the foundations in it, and because we don't really need the NCOP's signature on this, this is something that we really shouldn't delay on.
Thank you, Chairperson. For people who are new on the committee, it would be helpful if we are just given an example of what is meant by, or an example of legislation that were in conflict. Can we just be given an example of that so that we have a better understanding? And secondly, in relation to protocol matters, one would want to know what the diplomatic passport policy is about, and if we can also maybe be informed about what informs a decision, for example, for members of parliament to have diplomatic passports or official passports when they're on official business, because we know that some use diplomatic passports while we are using official passports. Thank you.
Chair, thanks very much. I will align myself with revising the bill in its as it is. I would just want two areas for the state law advisor to just assure us. The constitutionality, are there no any other constitutionality disputes? Because that's where you normally find a problem when there's a bill. The other one would be for her now to just give us a process going forward so that we'll know from now where are we going. Thanks very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. Mine is seeking clarity. On clause 9 of the bill, it says that the Minister of DERCO is the caretaker of the immovable assets, but we must not read it in isolation to the GIAMA clause 13, 1 and 2, which states that the accounting officer of a custodian for all immovable assets. So I want to know the clarity, because the presenter made it clear that before immovable assets can be disposed by the caretaker, which would be the Minister of DERCO, it must be done in consultation with Public Works, Minister of Public Works and Minister of Finance. At the end of the day, who would have the final word, and who is the true custodian then of the immovable assets, if you have to read the two clauses in conjunction? And then with regards to clause 5A, fit and proper, what does that mean for a human being to be fit and proper? Does it not isolate a certain class of people, which I would not want to mention as unfit and improper, but I want a clarified definition of what is fit and proper. And I want to appreciate that this bill will, at the end of the day, curb what we found from our oversight, that certain municipalities and provinces and other departments within this National Assembly go abroad without informing DERCO, where you find duplication of visits by state members. And then my last one, Chair, does it mean then we are saying Home Affairs or Department of Justice is now seconding their employees to DERCO, or they will still remain under their department but fully managed by DERCO? Thank you very much.
Honorable
Mstane was the last person. How? No, isn't it, Honorable Chair? What Honorable Chair is always avoiding is to speak as the last person. That is why they said that he was the first one on this matter. Because if the last person, you normally say you cover. And I'm covered by other honorable members. This is the last person. Thank you.
Hey, that was progressive, ne? Yeah. So yeah, I'm going to allow Advocate David to respond to questions which are raised by honorable members. But the general view is that we must revive the bill. So I think, Advocate, you are going to assist us to that particular way forward.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and all honorable members, for your questions. I want to perhaps just mention that there's only one sub-clause that is in contention, and that is clause 2, sub-paragraph 2, and that is on the application. Clause 2.1 has also been approved or adopted by the Select Committee or approved, yeah. So just to highlight that, there's only one sub-clause, and that is on the conflict of legislation. I'm just going to talk about questions that we directed specifically. Examples of legislation that is in conflict. You know, when the three legal advisors, from our side, Mr. Mpongoshe is also part of the team. He's just fortunately having a holiday break at the moment. But we put our heads together to actually get to a situation where there will be a direct conflict. And I must confess, they were not. But what we did find, for instance, let's just talk about a transfer recall that recall or placement and so on. In terms of the Public Service Act, there's a clause on transfer, but that clause doesn't particularly pertain to what we see as a transfer abroad. That transfer is usually you can be transferred to any other department or any other position in the department, and we needed something much more specific. So that is one aspect that comes to mind. Also, the whole issue of recall is nowhere in any legislation. Now, there might be an issue of is a recall actually a transfer as provided in the Public Service Act, because recall is very, very limited and specific. So that are examples of where we see that there might be not really a conflict, but there's a need for clarity in which act will apply. There was also a question on protocol. In other words, what informed the government's position on what type of passports can be granted or can be issued to which category of officials, parliamentary committees, members of parliament, the judiciary, etc. There is currently a policy, but that policy also needs to be looked at and firmed up, and that will become part of the regulations. That is to avoid discretionary implementation of the provisions of that policy. I will not talk about the constitutionality because I have very, very much more authoritative colleagues here that can speak on the constitutionality, the disputes that might be possible and so on, based against this Foreign Service Bill on the basis that it's constitutionally not not sound. So I don't know whether you want to discuss now.
Chairperson, the question on the fit and proper person, I was asked by honourable member, I would answer that question, and my colleague from the Federal Advisor will speak to the constitutionality of the bill that the committee has asked. Just to state that the concept of fit and proper person is not is not outlined in legislation, it's not legislated. However, the courts have developed it as a value judgment that is used to denote to the person's integrity, reliability, and honesty. Together, that person is used as a value judgment to judge whether the person meets those characteristics and therefore is fit and proper to hold office. We have a number of decided cases, Chairperson, where the courts have applied this principle, including the expert Ngwenya versus the Society of Advocates of South Africa 2006 judgment, which we can forward to the honourable member just for ease of reference. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chair. And with regard to the constitutionality of the bill, we have certified the bill as constitutional, and that provision which provides for the conflict of laws, it's, as the Department stated earlier on, it's a very, it happens a lot in legislation, and there's a presumption in law that when you have two laws which conflicts, the law dealing with a specific provision would trump the general law. And in this case, the Foreign Services Bill is a law specifically dealing with foreign services, and that would trump the general provisions of the public service. And that conflict only comes, the trumping will only happen if there's a conflict. So if there's no conflict and it can work in harmony, we have intergovernmental relations, legislation, we have all those mechanisms where departments or organs of state should work together to harmonize things, and if at the end of it all there is a conflict, then the specific law will trump the general law. Thanks.
Thank you very much, and thank you so much to the colleagues that assisted in answering that. On clause 9, we just want to make clear that we are not going to reinvent the wheel. GIAMA is quite an extensive piece of legislation, and many of the provisions there we have already been adopting in our current management of foreign assets. So it is very important to note that there will not be any reinvention of the wheel. What we need to do is to add to that to make sure that it is fit for the particular situation that we found with our state properties in foreign jurisdictions. The custodian will be indeed the Minister of Durco. We have built in and in various consultations with the line departments involved, that is Finance and Public Works, it was agreed that the Minister will consult first, and after such consultation she will then make the decision based on that consultation. Of course, the money that will come from that disposal will go to the National Fiscus, so it will not come back to Durco, and therefore it was deemed appropriate to have a consultation clause, and then the Minister will take the final decision. Of course, there will be strict guidelines, and it's already in the legislation that will apply for her to make that decision. Just to have absolute clarity, this will not be, nobody will be seconded to Durco. a person that would perform part of the Foreign Service will remain in his department. What is indeed, as the Honourable Member indicated, it will more be of a management nature and a reporting structure, so that the head of mission is not confronted by an official from another department that says, I'm only reporting to my head office and not to you, and because we have seen that several times. So it's not a secondment, the person is being transferred, he is in his department, he will go back to his department once his service has ended. But it is about the proper administration and management of the whole component that would be a transfer. Then about the general procedures now, Madam, do you specifically ask what happens now if the committee would decide to revive the bill? And here, can I again ask, Nati, would you be, you are the most wise one on these things. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, the issue of revival of the bill is provided for in the National Assembly rules. And a bill can be revived in one of two ways, Chairperson. Anyone. Please repeat, Chair. I must go back to the National. If you could just give me a moment to quote that very rule, Chairperson. The matter relating to lapsing of bills, Chairperson, and revival of such bills is on Rule 333, read with Rule 335, as well as established practice in terms of Rule 2 of the said rules, Chairperson. The Honourable Chair, the revival can be done in one of two ways, Chairperson. That's speaking directly to the issue of revival. It can be done in one of two ways. One would be where the executive initiates the process by relevant minister writing to the leader of government business, who in turn writes to the speaker, requesting that a motion be moved in the House for the bill to be revived, because the bill can only be revived by way of a motion in the Assembly. That's the first option, Chairperson. And the second option is, if in the wisdom of the committee it was that the bill must be revived, as I've observed in this committee, Chairperson, the committee also has an option to approach the speaker through a letter from the chairperson, indicating that, and copying the chief whip, indicating that a motion be moved in the House for the revival of the said bill. And the process will then commence for the bill to be revived, Chairperson. And when that motion is adopted, then the bill will be formally referred to the committee for it to be properly before the committee for consideration and further processing. Thank you, Chair.
There you have it, Honourable Members. We are saying we must revive the bill, and then that means we have to follow the process of writing to the speaker and copying the chief whip, and then move a motion in the National Assembly. Oh, that's the view. Honourable Mulder, I'm summarizing and you're raising your hand. Is there something contrary to my summary that you want to
say? Yes, ma'am. I think there's agreement that the bill should be revived, and we've just been informed by the advisor, parliamentary law advisor, that there's more than one way to do that. There are two ways to do that. The committee has not discussed the two options, and I thought that it would be appropriate if we could spend 1 minute in discussing the two alternative options.
I think we can do that when the chief state law advisor is done and recused. Then as the committee, we are going to remain and interrogate this issue. So I was just summarizing the view of the House, so that the legal minds are able to assist us so that when we remain behind, we are able to discuss from a viewpoint of informed persons that are lawmakers of the country. Is that good? Is that fine with you?
I don't have a problem with that now.
Oh, okay. You must allow the chair to chair. Are you done, advocate?
Yes, madam. And just to say thank you so much for this opportunity to present the Foreign Service Bill to you. Thank you.
Thank you, advocate and the team of Parliament Legal Services. From time to time, we'll call on you when we need legal advice, not only on this bill, but on another thing as well. So you don't get tired to fly in and out of Cape Town. So thank you very much. You can be excused so that you remain. Honourable members, the general feeling of the meeting is that we must survive the bill, right? And then I want us to interrogate that. Which processes do we use to revive the bill? I know that there's a process already which the minister started. And we were informed that the bill is stuck there with the leader of government business the last time we checked. So there's this other process which is suggested by the legal advisor of parliament, and these two processes are not conflicting processes. So I think we need to interrogate that and come to a particular decision before we could write a letter to the speaker on this particular issue. Honourable Mulder, do you want to lead us?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson.
The legal advisors technically gave us the correct advice that, as you correctly pointed out, there are two processes. I was not aware of the fact that there's already some action taken from the minister's side and that she's already contacted the leader of government business. All I would like to say from my perspective would be that if I look at the history of the bill basically originated with the executive. It's not a bill that originated with the parliament itself. And I think the first instance would be for the minister to decide whether she wants to revive the bill, and I can't think that there's any reason why she would not want to revive the bill. So all I would ask is that before the committee perhaps take a decision that we take the initiative, that there be some consultation between yourself or whoever's in charge, or between the committee and the minister in that sense. And that I think the feeling is we want to see the bill revived and get it through Parliament as soon as possible, that we just either consult with the minister or allow the minister to proceed from her point of view. Thank you.
There you have it. Okay.
So the consultation with the minister won't hold any water, as per the clarification of Parliament Legal Department, by the way, because the process of the leader of government business to revive that bill, it's not a process which is going to hinder on our processes. They will converge at one office, the office of the speaker. Instead, the two processes will strengthen each other so that the speaker and parliament could realize the agency of the bill. I'm happy that we are not in disagreement in terms of clause 2. There, I think that was the only thing that will hold us as a committee from assisting the process to move forward. Honorable Mulder and Honorable Bachmann have been in this portfolio since, and the frustration of a bill which was rejected by the NCOP is something that we got on arrival to this committee, some of us who are fairly new to the portfolio committee. Now that's why we took a conscious decision to say the Foreign Service Bill should be on top of our priorities. It can't be that this bill will still be returned 2015. It's what now, 4 years later, the bill has not been approved or signed or processed. It's still stuck somewhere. So I think our focus should be on ensuring that the bill is processed through proper channels, and that as a committee, at least in this first year of our term, we are able to register an achievement which is very meaningful, not only for the committee, but for the department and South Africa and the world, because the bill is not about us. It is also going to assist probably the AG in all the things that he raised to be addressed meaningfully, because some of the things that the AG has raised in his report, they are dependent on this particular bill's approval by Parliament. So I think let these things move concurrently. The PLO from the Office of the Minister is here. I take it as if Luyanda, you are reporting to the Minister, because things can't wait for me to have a convo with her when you are a representative of that particular office. Well, now you know how to get hold of her when she's in Botswana or UK or, you know, all around the world, you know. Mina, I won't, and we can't wait for her to come back abroad for us to process some of the things. So I would suggest that processes move concurrently, and then we will brief the minister when the time permits, of course, because we must brief her on some of the things. By the way, Honorable Mulder, we have not seen the minister since our orientation there, we have not even briefed you about the orientation, but we are a train moving, not the bullet train, don't I? No, we are just a train moving. We can be silver as long as silver train is moving, but we are not a bullet train. I refuse to be a bullet train myself. Honorable Chetty, Honorable Bant.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman. I concur with you. Just to put it on record as well, that in as much as it might also be a priority for the Minister to address it, it's more of a priority to us as a committee. The Minister herself might have other priorities as well, and this might just not be her top priority. But in the interest of this committee, this is our priority number one, and it's no contradiction or not in conflict with both those applications going to the Speaker's office. And like you said, it might just escalate the urgency of why we want this to be dealt with. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, in things like this, I think it's important to have time frames of the consultation and then the movement of this proposal. So I think, Chair, I would propose a minimum of 2 weeks. Of 1 week, man. Sorry. A minimum of 1 week for a consultation. With the minister for France to talk to, give me a maximum of 1 week, starting today. So that next week he didn't get hold of the minister.
Mamela, we've now got two hands, two eyes, two legs, a moria of papers, and a computer. I'm going to write that letter to the speaker today. Right? And then the letter will go to the speaker. And then I will consult with the minister. In fact, Luyanda will brief the minister as we leave this, that this is what we are going to embark on. However, when she comes back, we will meet with her so that we do a consultation on this particular matter. So that's why I was saying, let's move concurrently. What if the minister says yes? What if the minister says no? Are we going to sit here as a committee and say no? The minister is saying no. You are going to be like this other minister that ESCOM must wait for before the ESCOM reports to the committee. I don't want to be that committee myself. That a committee can't report. I mean, ESCOM can't report when the minister is not there. The minister must be there. And then the minister ends up reporting on behalf of ESCOM. I don't want to be that committee myself. I can't. So we need to move things concurrently like that. So whether the minister agrees or the minister does not agree, but the processes must move. If as a portfolio committee we see a need and saw it fit that the bill must be revived, it must be revived, because the reason why the minister took the bill to the leader of government business, it's because she also wants the bill to be revived. So that's why I'm confident that there will be no conflict between us and the minister, because she has started the process. Now, the process and that process are going to complement each other. That's my take on the process, and I think if we are in agreement as a committee, let us write to the speaker and talk the revival of the bill. Probably the leader of government business will feel pressure as well, because that thing has been there since, I mean, it's been how many weeks now? It's been there since, I mean, really, too long. So when we write that letter, probably it will trigger the sense of urgency on the other side, so that we move quickly. So if there is nothing, honorable members, we can adjourn the meeting and have lunch, because lunch is prepared because our team thought that our meeting will end at 2 o'clock. No, 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 no. We've got a lot of things to do, except to sit in the committee. There are things to be done, like I must go and write a letter. And that letter requires proper English. So I'll have to think and think deeply. Because borrowing English from England is not an easy thing. England is very far. So honorable members, if there's nothing from the honorable members, we can adjourn our meeting and have our lunch, have a good day. We'll meet in the honorable house. We are doing our condolence messages and statements.